You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
This is a Boardwalk Audio podcast.
This is Pop Wilfong.
I'm Joe Canale.
I'm Ryan Tweedy.
I'm Pat Jansen.
And Mike Canale.
All right, so you know who's here now.
For Nebraska and the Scarlet.
From Van Nuys, California.
About 15 miles away from Hollywood, California.
It's the Big Red Cobcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Greg Cobb. I'm Ryan.
I'm Pat.
And we are Joe-less today.
There is no Joe Canale.
There is no Joe Canale. He wanted to be here.
He's got a kid.
He's got a kid and a wife. I mean, I got a wife. You got a wife.
I have a wife.
We don't have kids.
Nope. We have pets, though.
I do. I have two pets.
I have two as well.
Mine are dogs, though. His are cats, so mine are better.
All right, whatever. I can't debate it. Yeah.
Oh, so we just wanted to take a moment because last week we had the really great Charlie McBride interview that ended up being way more informative than we even imagined. And
Charlie's one of our favorite dudes.
Yeah, Charlie's a really, really good dude. And so that was great that he did that. And this week we have a guy named Paul Dalen on.
Yeah.
Who is a statistician.
Yes. Little side note. We've already talked to him.
Yeah, so you can go back and find. Yeah, oh yeah, today you mean.
Correct.
Yeah, we actually already talked to him, so we know what he says.
But we're not going to tell you just yet.
Yeah,
you got to listen to the rest of it.
But before we do that, we just wanted to take a chance because we're on a new website. We're on Husker Max now, who has been Dave Max. I don't know if anybody knows. That's Husker Max. As well as Joe Hudson, who runs the website aspect of it. Those are the two main guys over there, and they were gracious enough to invite us on and to let us be a part of their website. I've worked with Dave for years now. I've been working with them for over 4 years
on
various projects.
At least that, yeah.
And so that's where we are now, and since there's a new audience, we just wanted to take the time to introduce ourselves to those of you that don't know who we are.
Yeah, and for those of you who do, because we've got a lot of people
coming over, yeah, for sure.
But yeah, that other guy that I'm pointing to that you can't see is Ryan Tweedy.
Yes.
And this guy here that's me, I'm Pat Jansen, and we've got Joe Canale, who's on the podcast regularly as well. That's us. We're the Big Red Cobcast. We've done this for almost 200 episodes now.
Yeah, I think this is episode 186 or 187.
It's at least 187. We've done 186, I think.
Okay, then it's 187. I can just look at the thing because I named it. Episode 187 with Paul Dalen.
There we go.
And so what this podcast is, for those of you, we do a lot of interviews. The last year, it's been a little bit harder because nobody wants to come talk about a four-win season.
Although four loss seasons aren't very interesting either.
They really, yeah, they're just kind of vanilla.
We've had a lot of those.
We do have quite a few more interviews lined up in the vein of Charlie McBride. We try to find really interesting guys like Paul Dalen.
Mm-hmm. You should absolutely listen.
Yeah, it's fucking...
In a couple...
Dang it! I promised Dave I wouldn't swear.
Well, now you gotta.
I'm gonna bleep it.
So that's the other thing. If anybody is coming over, we're doing our best to make our mothers proud.
And by mothers, we mean Dave.
Yeah, and actually, my mother.
Oh, like, really? Your mother didn't like it?
Well, actually, no. My dad. I told my dad that we're gonna do our best to cut out the F-bombs. He's like, I don't have a problem with that.
I'm sure a lot of people don't. There's gonna be a couple guys that are like, I only listen to you because you guys swear so much. So for those,
we're still
guys,
gonna be irreverent. Yeah. We're still gonna be us. Yeah. It's just one word.
Yeah. And that's sort of the thing. We try not to take Husker football too seriously. We try not to idolize the gods that everybody else does. Given we are diehard Husker fans, and I still think that Tommy Frazier is the greatest college quarterback of all time.
He's got to take that Creighton shirt off, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know what? Actually, I take that back. He's not. He's
Scott
not.
Frost.
He's the fourth greatest Husker quarterback of all time now. Number one, Scott Frost. Number two, Brooke Baringer. Number three,
Jerry Taggy.
Number four,
Dave Hum. Five, Vince Ferragamo.
Yeah, you know what they didn't do? They didn't put on a stupid...
Six, Matt Turman.
Yeah. I'm sorry, seven, Taylor Martinez. Because he didn't put on a goddamn Creighton blue hoodie pullover. How are you going to be a national championship...
I think it was a Creighton sweater vest at that.
How are you going to be the national championship winning quarterback and be a Jasker? If they ever asked me to do that, if they said, hey, Cobcast Ryan, Mr. Ryan Tweedy, maker of Through These Gates, will you come stand on the basketball court and wear a Jasker hoodie and wave at the crowd? I'd go, yeah, of course I can. And then I'd walk out and I'd light it on fire.
You do like a heel turn, like pull it off,
yeah.
Husker shirt underneath, stomp on the Creighton shirt.
And everybody wearing red in that stadium would go nuts.
Yeah.
Be a legend.
Man, we've totally tipped our hand. Creighton, we're not planning on doing that. You can offer us, wink.
Wink. I would love to come be a Jasker with you, wink. Speaking of Jaskers, today's the Creighton game.
Yeah, by the time you're hearing this, it will be over.
And I predict a Husker W.
Yes.
69-3.
Yes. Great defense, Timmy Miles.
So what else do we need to tell these people?
Listen to the interview in 30 seconds.
I mean about us before.
Oh, about us.
I feel like we've covered it.
We've covered it. They'll figure it out.
Yeah, but keep listening. Subscribe to us on iTunes.
Follow us on Twitter at Big Red Cobcast.
Yeah.
And just love us, guys.
And go to HuskerMax.com. And, I don't know, buy something from
Or just click on a bunch of articles.
Yeah, just click on a bunch of articles, click on some forums. Do what you got to do. He's a good dude. He's been helping us out. And welcome to Paul Dalen.
Yeah.
Bye. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Big Red Cobcast. You will probably have already heard a little intro thing from us, but still welcome again.
Nah, we can do it after that.
What's that?
We can talk about us after this.
Okay.
We can do it however we want.
Yeah.
You're Ryan.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Pat.
And today we have a super interesting guest on. He's been on before.
Mm-hmm.
And I get very fascinated by this kind of stuff because numbers don't lie, Pat.
They don't?
No, numbers only tell the truth.
I just assume everybody's lying all the time.
Yeah, people are.
Oh, okay.
People are dirty, filthy liars. But numbers are not. So today we have Paul Dalen on. Paul, welcome.
Yeah. Hey, Paul.
Hey. Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. Of course, man. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, but we now are on HuskerMax.com, but Paul is one of our good friends from Coronation. And so thanks to both places. But, yeah. Paul, what's kind of you're a numbers guy. How did you become a numbers guy, and how does it relate to your Husker fandom?
Oh, gosh. The 30-second version is somewhere in early college, late high school, I forget when, I came across a copy of Bill James' Almanac of Baseball at a garage sale. I can't remember the year. I wish I still had the thing with me, but it's been gone for years. And it condensed or had several hundred pages of the kinds of statistics that I'd been collecting on the on baseball cards and football cards, or not football cards, but basketball cards, since I was a little kid. Always had a passion for sports statistics. And from there, I learned about, reading that about, sort of this, advanced way of thinking about statistics and how a lot of the metrics that we used in baseball were all kind of messed up. They were measuring the wrong thing. And so I've always had that kind of passion for statistics. And that kind of led me in a career. Oddly enough, I took a brief diversion as a fairly typical military officer, but then got back into a statistical analysis kind of role as an operations researcher for the Army. Oh, by the way, today is the Army-Navy game. By the time this airs, we'll all know the results. But I just have to make a plug for go Army, beat Navy.
And by typical soldier, what he means is he personally found Bin Laden. He's just very humble.
Anyway, I've been a Nebraska fan for a very, very long time. Oddly enough, I grew up in Iowa. I have this regular back and forth with some of the other writers and on Coronation. In fact, I think, Ryan, I think you've said some things. There's a lot of Iowa hate there. I'm actually an Iowa alum. But
are you really?
Please don't. I am.
You just lost all credibility.
but my heart is definitely with Nebraska. And anyone that knows me will know that there's never a question of when Iowa is playing Nebraska. Who my heart is.
How did you deal with that smell for 4 years?
I was, you know what? All jokes aside, Iowa's a beautiful campus. It's a great school. It's got a great heritage. It's a beautiful campus. Iowa City is a great place to be.
Because I respect you, I'm going to not say anything.
No, that's fine, guys. You can. I realize that we've tried to create this, and I don't know if it's because they have roughly the same colors as Colorado, but try to transfer this way we despise the vermin to making Iowa fit into that mold, and they just don't.
Okay, wait, hold on. I'm going to counter argue that with this. So when I made Through These Gates, I met every kind of fan I interviewed every fan in the Big Ten. I went to several away games, right? We went to we went to every game that year except Purdue. So we saw every Nebraska game and every away game, right? The only school that gave me any trouble during interviews, the only school was Iowa.
Really?
Not Michigan, not Ohio State, not Wisconsin, who I've heard is horrible. But Wisconsin was in Lincoln that year. Maybe that's why. But Iowa fans, they kept running into my camera and yelling things into it about how, like, horrible things that I'm not allowed to say on this podcast anymore. So that's how I feel about Iowa.
Oh, hey, then I don't really know how to answer that. I don't want to turn this into an Iowa apology tour. I'm just going to say that my experience in Iowa City was good. And I never had the chance to attend school, in Lincoln. And if it were possible, I certainly would. Nebraska has a great sports statistics master's and PhD program. And I would love to get into that program, but right now I've just completed a move to San Antonio and have a new second career going on, so that's just not going to happen right now.
Where are you from originally, Paul?
I'm a little town in Iowa, in northwest Iowa, called Spencer. It's just south of the Okoboji area.
Yeah, I'm familiar with Spencer.
Okay.
Well, so you went to school in Iowa, you're from Iowa, you're a Husker fan, still rooting for Nebraska. I mean, I hate to continue on this, but How's that happen?
Well, let's back up. I went to graduate school at Iowa. I went to a small college over in Sioux Center in Sioux County, Iowa, just west, over towards Sioux Falls, called Dort College.
Yeah,
not Dork, Dort.
D-O-R-D-T.
Yeah. The NAIA volleyball, women's volleyball runner-ups this 2 years in a row now. So there's a plug for my alma mater volleyball team there. So I did graduate school at in Iowa, and actually I didn't even graduate from there. I just did the 1 year there and figured out that that wasn't what I wanted to do, and then that's when my time in the military began after that.
Oh, okay. That's man. So you found Bin Laden years before we were looking for. So we were briefly talking before we started, just because this is going to get a little bit precise,
heady,
right? But I like that, and I think that our fans do too. I know they liked it the first time we did it. So you were mentioning that you went through some stuff with, I can never say his name, Chinander.
Yeah,
I gotta learn.
Well, I think that's how I pronounce it, right?
I gotta learn.
That's
all
how I've
names.
Been saying it.
Yeah, Chinander. I'm gonna say it with like a redneck accent, Chinander.
You gotta say it with a Jersey Shore accent with his haircut and beard.
I don't know what that would sound like.
Chinander.
Okay, I don't know. That was not good.
I know.
So what have you been looking at over the UCF defense, Paul?
Let me preface this by saying that I think Scott Frost has put together a terrific team. He's obviously had amazing success on the field. He's been a head coach at a championship level. He's been an assistant coach at a championship level. He's played at a championship level.
Yeah.
He has played in the NFL for championship level coaches. Scott Frost has been surrounded by winning his entire career. And I think that that is an element that has really been missing at Nebraska for a long time. That is a whole lot of winning that on a resume that we've never had before.
And now, is this something that would work out number wise from a guy like you, is that the best way to tell about future performance is past performance?
Yes and no. That's a dangerous thing to say, that because X has always happened, it will continue to happen. That kind of gets into the joke about the turkey that gets fed every morning when the farmer walks up, and he learns that when the farmer walks up that he can go up and get fed, which is fine until the day before Thanksgiving. And then all of a sudden, past does not necessarily at that point predict the future.
Fair enough.
That being said,
poor turkey.
I know.
There is a good deal of evidence to say that that coaches tend to do what they've done in the past, particularly if it has worked in the past, sometimes to the point of being overly convinced of the effectiveness of it and unwilling to recognize that there are sometimes other factors that could be playing into it. And not just their own extraordinary abilities.
Okay.
Coaches are fairly big ego kinds of people. I think they have to be for the demands of the job.
Right.
But that lends itself sometimes to an inability to recognize that they aren't in control of everything, which all means that, yes, if a coach has had success in the past doing something, that's a pretty good predictor that they're going to continue to have success in the future. Not always. There are almost always ups and downs to any career. But I think that hiring a successful coach and giving them the resources to continue to do what they've done is a good way to allow them to have success in the future.
Well, to digest your analytical statement and spew it back out as a rhetorical statement, I think one of the the key strengths of Tom Osborne over the years was his ability to adapt and evolve and grow. And people tend to compare Scott Frost to Tom Osborne because they have at least a lot of personality similarities. And, you know, he's learned under a lot of different coaches as well. I feel like, without necessarily having the evidence in front of me to nail it down, I think one of the strengths of Scott Frost potentially could be his ability to grow and evolve, because he's already done that as a coach several times.
I absolutely, that's an indisputable statement, but it's not the whole story. Yes, Tom Osborne grew and evolved, but he grew and evolved with a staff that grew and evolved, sort of grew and evolved him. We had a discussion on the Coronation Slack sometime this week about Charlie McBride and his the change in Nebraska's defensive front after we continued to get our butts kicked by Florida schools for several years in a row. I think Charlie McBride went down to Miami to learn their 4-3 defensive front system.
Why did he not ever tell us that? Because that's a really interesting story.
I don't know. We'll have to get him back on.
That's not hidden news.
I've never heard it. I also was pretty young when Charlie McBride would have been.
Yeah, he went from a 5-3 to a 4-3.
5-2 to a 4-3.
Or 5-3. They had fewer defensive backs. Anyway, Paul.
Anyways, go ahead.
So I guess what I'm saying is that it takes – it's not necessarily, in my opinion, the head coach's job to put those particular changes in place. It's the head coach's job to understand what his coordinators are doing and have coordinators, I would say, and possibly even position coaches – again, this is my opinion that are the actual nuts and bolts, X's and O's experts at exactly what they're trying to do, which kind of gets back with my concern about Frost's choice of Chenander as a defensive coordinator. His record at UCF was not that spectacular as a defensive coordinator. It certainly isn't, in terms of a scoring defense anyway, anywhere near what Nebraska will need to be at to compete for conference and eventually national championship trophies. The Scott Frost offense is, but not the defense. And it's going to... I guess the jury is still out on whether Chenander can be that guy that can adapt to a different style of football being played in the Big Ten as opposed to the Pac-12 or the American Conference. I have all kinds of notes here, so this would be a good place. I'll pull this up. For instance, and I know that Chenander was a coordinator at. Or excuse me, not even a coordinator. He was just an outside linebackers coach, along with Frost at Oregon in 2014 and 15. In 2014, Oregon was 23.6 points per game scoring defense, and then kind of fell off a cliff in 2015 at 37.6 points per game. Now, again, he was just a position coach, so you can't hang that completely on him. But then he went to UCF with Frost in 2016 and 2017 at 24.6 and 25.1 points per game. Quite a bit better than the 37.6 points, but consistent in line with the 2014 numbers, which is all I could find for his coaching history.
Right.
As I was trying to research this.
Now
that is.
Oh, go ahead.
That's probably enough to win 10, maybe even 11, games per year, which certainly will assure him of staying in a job. But it's nowhere near the kind of points per game defense that Nebraska will need to be to get past Wisconsin and then past Ohio State and eventually competing for at the national championship level. It'll have to cut that down to probably below 16 or 15 points per game to be competing at the elite national level.
Okay.
While maintaining the offensive production that Frost has shown that he's capable of doing.
Okay, so, I mean, my question is, and this could relate to both offense and defense, because when you inherit a program, because certainly they were only at UCF for 2 years, you inherit what's already been there, and that was a team that was 0-12, and now they're inheriting a Nebraska team that went 4-8. I mean, the pieces may not necessarily be the pieces that fit what you're coming in for. So if there's a... So UCF dropped quite a bit as far as the number of points they were allowing per year from 2015 to 2017. So couldn't that necessarily be labeled an improvement on Chenander's part? And also, Scott Frost, it's no guarantee that they're going to put up the points that they did at UCF coming into Nebraska because they don't necessarily have the pieces for that either. So, I mean... Isn't it possible too then that what we've seen at UCF, both the good and the bad, isn't necessarily going to translate right away?
No, I don't think it will. And here's why. Chenander's performance at UCF, again, 24.6 points per game in 2016 and 20. And in 17, it was 25.1. Okay, in 2015, when UCF went 0-12, they had 37.7 points per game that they were giving up. They got hammered. Now, I cannot understand what happened, what kind of team infighting was going on, but that team completely imploded in George O'Leary's last year. But here's the thing. In from 2009 to 2014, they averaged 20 points per game. A scoring defense of 20.1 points per game, and so both of Chenander's years at Central Florida, with the exception of O'Leary's 2015 team. His defenses, points-wise anyway, are the worst two that UCF had since 2009.
Wow.
Let me restate that again. In 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14, UCF had an average scoring defense of 20 points per game. Under Chenander, they had an average of about 24.7 points per game. Now, in the math that I do on the statistics, that translates to one or two games expected loss per season of giving up three extra points per game on defense. That is not a good thing. I don't see any evidence in Chenander's performance at UCF to justify $800,000 salary and a defensive coordinator job at Nebraska. I think that he is riding Scott Frost's coattails of his extraordinary coaching ability, as well as an amazing offensive production.
Now, okay, which is, and I've heard that opinion a few times now. So let me ask you this: if you look, do you have the do you have the last season UCF stats in front of you?
Not the complete stats. I can
defensive,
pull them up.
Do we defensive want to... stats. Well, okay. So I guess my question is, if you look at, and I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I kind of have a vague idea of what they were. So if you look at UFC, if you look at UCF's numbers per game, like the yards the defense have allowed and the points that they allowed, those last two games were like 650-yard games or 600-yard games, right?
On both sides of the ball.
Yeah, on both sides of the ball. It was just a scoring explosion on both sides. It was crazy.
Which can have an effect, too.
Right. But if you take those two games away, those numbers aren't as staggering. I believe if you take those two games away, the average is something like 300 yards per game. But don't quote me on that. Which is fairly respectable.
It is. If you have put a lot of stock in how, you know, the significance of number of yards.
Right.
I'm really unconvinced from a statistics standpoint that number of yards means a lot. Other than it's fun to watch.
Yeah, right.
Those two games against South Florida and Memphis were very entertaining football. That was the epitome of basketball on grass out there. But it doesn't really translate into a lot of predictive success that, you know, a 49-42 or 62-55 victory in the math comes out to be, you expect to lose one of those. If you regularly are playing football with scores approaching the half century mark and are winning by a touchdown or less, that's not a good thing. In the big picture, you don't want that. It's great to get to 50, but it's even better if you get to 50 and you hold your opponent to 10.
Right.
That has a strong predictive value towards winning in the future. But I agree that it was fun, but I don't buy that a lot of yards really matters because they gave up a ton of yards too.
Right.
I know in the Memphis game, both teams, that was one of the top 10 most yards total in NCAA history.
It was the highest yards per in a game this season for sure.
It was for this season, but I'm pretty sure it's in the top 10 of all time. It was an extraordinary game. Very fun to watch, but not what we really want to see in the future in Memorial Stadium, I don't think.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting to me that you said yards were kind of not as important of a stat. And I realize we're talking Nebraska and Central Florida and all that, but I just have one thing that's kind of always stuck in my craw for a while, because I've always felt like time of possession was basically the equivalent of batting average in baseball, where the stat is kind of overrated. Definitely. As an analytical mind, how do you feel time of possession, the importance of that as far as a stat in football?
Well, it's fun. It has some value to it. If you never have the football, odds are you're never going to win the game. But especially as the way college football has evolved today, teams score really, really fast.
Mm-hmm.
Frost teams at Oregon were ridiculously fast scoring, chewing up huge chunks of yards, and in some ways giving up huge chunks of yards as well. If you can score in 3 minutes and then get the ball back and score again in 3 minutes and probably get the ball back, you will have a good time of possession. But in the end, you have to score. Time of possession doesn't really mean anything unless it results in 7 points at the end. There is probably, just to get back to the talking about Nebraska of the 80s and 90s, it is a really demoralizing thing to an opponent to get smashed over and over and over again for 3 yards at a time for a 19-yard drive that chews up 12 minutes of clock time and ends in a touchdown. It doesn't do any good, however, to get smashed for 12 minutes on a 90-yard drive and have the team turn it over. So that's 12 minutes of wasted time of possession that means absolutely nothing. It has a meaningful statistic in football has to be tied to what it produces, points per drive, as some kind of efficiency measure, for instance. In the end, the only two statistics that really matter in football are how many points you score and how many points you allow your opponent to score.
All that statistical analysis, that's what we end up with.
Yeah. It's funny, though, because that's sort of what numbers do, right? They simplify the glaring holes that people are overlooking, yeah?
Right. And that sounds, when I say that those two things are really, when you boil everything down to the skeleton of what it means to play football, that's the only thing that's left. But still, if you look at the box score after a football game, there is a lot of other stuff in there that's kind of golly gee whiz interesting to know. You know, are we going to get a 1,000-yard receiver, for instance? That's fun, and I'm glad when we finally get one. I wish Stanley would have gotten one extra long catch or something so he would have gotten there. But it doesn't tell you how well the team did. The only things that matter for that particular measure, and I think we can all agree that the only real metric that at the end anyone cares about is a W or an L in that particular column. The only things that directly impact that are how many points you score and how many points your opponent scores. So if you can't tie every other statistic to scoring points or keeping the other team from scoring points, then it doesn't do you a lot of good to track that. It's not telling you anything other than just interesting discussion material.
Okay, so let me ask this. So if you're looking at, let's say you're looking at time of possession, right? So if you can break it down to how many points they score on average per minute, let's say.
Okay.
Now that makes that a measurable statistic that actually matters.
It's meaningful. It has to be meaningful in the context of comparing it to perhaps the entire FBS or comparing it to your opponents. But if you're scoring on average 3 points per minute, well, that would be 180 points per game. That's unrealistic.
I think we've got a chance of a national championship if we do that.
Let's say you average 1 point per minute, and that would be an extraordinary scoring average,
right,
of 60 points per game. That does tell you something. I can go back and pull, 100 or more years of football. Actually, I don't, because everything prior to about 1980 doesn't really matter anymore. But I can tell you, if you average 60 points per game, what's your probability that you're going to win 12 games that year? And I can tell you it'll be really high. Almost virtually assured that you'll win 12 games if you average 60 points per game, regardless of what your defense does. Then that is a meaningful statistic. Just telling me we average 37 minutes of possession. Great. You're a ball hog. That's all that tells me. It doesn't really tell me anything else about what the team did, what they accomplished.
Well, the thing that I think people are often trying to get out of time of possession is basically offense affecting defense. And there's a lot of talk of that with Scott Frost and that high-paced offense. Like, does that put more undue stress on the defense? So I think there's a tie to those two things together. And do you think a high-flying offense can potentially create more of a statistical disadvantage for the defense?
There's two questions there. So 2 points. So I'll break them down.
Okay.
The first is there. Yes, there is in any statistic there is, or any facet of a game, from a statistical standpoint anyway, there's a yin and a yang of it. And for time of possession, which is kind of an analog for how fast an offense moves, it does. If you're averaging, 20 minutes time of possession per game, your defense is on the field twice as much as your offense. That probably isn't that great of a thing, and it probably will have an effect. I haven't figured out how to measure that, but intuitively I would agree that it's more tiring to play defense, and this is what other coaches have said, that it's more tiring as a player to play defense than it is to play offense. It's one of the reasons Nebraska in the 90s was able to use the offensive line to beat their opponents into submission, because the defense got tired faster than the offense did. So there is that opportunity cost that you pay to scoring really, really fast. Does that outweigh the demoralizing effect of a team regularly going out and chewing up 16, 18, 23 yards per play? I don't know. But there certainly is always a sort of a sweet spot or a sweet range of where you want to be. I don't think any team wants to, be at 20 points average time of possession per game, because that means that, well, unless that every one of those possessions is resulting in a touchdown, it probably means that their offense isn't very good.
Okay.
It does point to things. Like a really low time of possession means that you're off. I would say you should look and see whether your offense is any good, for starters, before we start talking about the efficiency of it. How many points per minute, for instance, that it's able to produce. Now, what was the second part of your question?
I'm not even sure I remember, Paul. Basically, the second part of it, I think, is what you answered, can a defense be put at a statistical disadvantage by a really high powered offense? So are Chenander's potentially poorer rankings on the statistical end potentially somewhat caused by the style of offense?
Yeah. That's a really good point. It is a very different overall, that the offense climate in the American Conference is much more similar to the Pac-12 or the Big 12 than it is to the Big 10 or the SEC. So I would say that yes, and here's how it does that. Over the course of the game or the course of a season, an up-tempo offense that just shaves 1 or 2 seconds, or say 5 seconds, off of each play of the play clock, by having a no-huddle offense, for instance, or getting to the line, just knowing what you're doing really, really fast. Because it takes a lot of work to run an offense that quickly. You have to have an entire team that is on the same page of music. For instance, Nebraska could not have run this year. The team never got on the same page of music with this. So to have that kind of up-tempo offense, you have to have the talent and the training and the development on the team that's capable of it. But if you do that, and the offense always knows what it's going to do before the ball snaps. The defense usually doesn't. They get cues. The defense will take cues from how the offense lines up, what they're doing, how they're acting. The less time that an offense gives the defense to recognize those cues, that ultimately becomes, it may be on every play, it may be just a tiny, maybe just a little bit of pressure on one side of the scale. But over the course of a game or an entire season, running an offense like that can have a big impact on swinging that advantage towards the offense and away from the defense, because it makes the defense more reactive. And I don't think you'll find any coach that ever wants to be reactive about anything. They want to, you know, coaches want to control. They want perfect information about everything. And one of the things that an up-tempo offense like that does is it reduces the time that the coaching staff has to react to that.
Well, I'd be really interested to see the number of snaps in an American Athletic Conference game like that UCF-Memphis game versus like an Ohio State-Wisconsin, like how many snaps and how many opportunities there are for the offense because of that high pace.
Well, I can give you that, actually.
Oh.
And it'd have to take a couple of minutes for me to dig this up.
Sure. Well, you were about to say something else, too, and I just like jumped in because this is interesting the hell out of me.
Actually, I don't remember what I was going to say.
Sorry.
Do you want me to look up the average number of snaps in a game versus in the American versus the Big Ten?
Yeah, I'd be into that.
Okay, so it looks to me like when we look at pass and rush plays, that the American Conference isn't that much different top to bottom than the Big Ten. And I don't have offhand or on hand right now those counts broken down by teams. I suspect that there is a quite a variety in the Big Ten. I know Indiana, for instance, plays a very different style of offense than Iowa. Offhand, I bet it's 20 or 30 plays per game difference, in fact. So I think the American would probably be facing about the same the same kind of statistics. And Scott Frost's offense, of course, would be on the high end of number of plays. They run fast, score a lot, run a lot of plays per game.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Did we derail any of the points you wanted to make about Chenander? I'm not sure if we let you finish on that because we sort of started going all over the place.
No, I want to make it clear my only point with Chenander was that I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the $800,000 salary. And granted, I'm not the guy that gets to determine salaries, but it seems like a lot of money for the defensive coordinator that other than competing against the 0-12 season had the two highest or the two worst scoring defenses in the last 9 years at UCF. I don't know how to put that into context other than he's getting a pretty good deal, and
I hope
he can rise to that occasion.
Was he the defensive coordinator under those two seasons?
Chenander, he was.
The two Frost seasons, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, he was Frost defensive coordinator at UCF in 16 and 17.
Okay, interesting.
And here's the thing, his defense in 17 wasn't all that different than it was. I mean, in terms of scoring defense, it actually went up. Now, it probably went up because they got in this basketball on grass shootout situation with Memphis and Southern or South Florida last two games. But even without that, it was still probably within a point average of where he was in 2016 when they went 6-5 or 5-7. I forget what – I can't even remember what they went in 2016. But it's rock solid last 2 years anyway, very consistent in defensive performance. And if that's what we want and we're willing to settle for 23 points per game – great, with an offense that averages in the high 40s, we probably will win, can count on winning 9 or 10 games a season. But I don't think that's where we want to be. So it's going to take some adjustment or possibly some coaching changes. Well, I'll leave that to Coach Frost and Bill Moos to figure that one out.
Well, my question kind of to we've talked a little bit about how one side can kind of affect the other is, you know, if you were to kind of remove some variables, say you move Chenander to a slower pace, to a team that has a slower paced offense like Iowa, or put Brent Venables in on a team that has Scott Frost calling the plays, do Chenander's defenses then start to allow lower points, or do Brent Venables' defenses start to allow more points? I mean, does that offense start to carry a lot of significant influence on the defense?
I think it probably does, but a guy that crafts a defense that typically averages in the low 20s per game is not going to suddenly start producing in the low teens per game. It is possible, and as evidence for that being possible, I look at Nebraska. Starting in 2004, our scoring defense was 25, 21, 28, 38 points per game in 2007.
Yuck.
28 in 2008, and then it dropped to 10.4 in 2009. Now, why did it drop to 2000? Because we had
Ndamukong
Suh and Jared Crick and Ndamukong Suh, which together those three made an absolutely impenetrable wall for teams to score against.
Yeah.
So Pelini's, or I guess it was Carl Pelini at the time, we still had those players that were 23, 24 point per game players on the rest of the team, but you introduced some true potential all-stars, and you can change that. But I don't think you can count on having, you know, an Ndamukong Suh or a Prince Mukamura every year.
Right.
Or ever again.
Once you get that momentum, Saban is able to sustain that momentum because those players want to go and they want to win multiple championships. It's tough to get there, I guess. And so you have these extraordinary seasons that sort of bubble to the top, but very quickly they sink back to the remaining averages of, and after that, I mean, we went back to 24, 28, 25, 26 points per scoring offense, and then we fired Pelini. So it at Nebraska, when you want to win championships, a scoring defense in the mid-20s is not going to do it, I guess is what I can say with a pretty high degree of confidence. Now, I don't know if Chenander can adjust or not. I don't know what's going to happen. But we'll wait and see.
Yeah, wait and see. And I just want to, because we were talking about coming back and talking about this other topic later, I think we should at least hit on it now a little bit just because it's really relevant.
Yeah, I know you were wanting to talk about it, and I took over. Sorry.
The Pythagorean theorem, which I always thought was an acute triangle way to find angles versus segments, but apparently it's also a way to predict football.
Pythagorean theorem, the real Pythagorean theorem is a squared plus b squared equals c squared, which is on a right triangle, not an acute triangle.
Oh, is it a right triangle? Okay, I knew it was something like that.
The hypotenuse, the long side opposite the 90-degree angle, is the sum of the squares of the other two sides.
Right.
You just got served mathematically.
I hope.
The Pythagorean theorem of football, or of sports for that matter, and it started with Bill James in the in baseball, is only, it looks like the Pythagorean theorem because it has three elements, all of which are squared or raised to an exponent. And it's just the points scored, so points four squared divided by the total points, or points four squared plus points against squared. Now, if you take the average for the season, or just the total number of points, and you plug them into that formula, what you get is a number between 0 and 1. That if you take that number times the number of games played, so like 0.75 times 12, say an expected wins of 8 wins, then you have a number that you say you based on your performance on the field. And again, getting back to my assertion that the only two statistics that really ever matter are how much you score and how much your opponents score. You have a metric that incorporates both of those. And you can say, based on the scores that of the football, or based on how you performed score-wise on the football field, you should have won 9 games this year. You only won 8. Well, what happened? There's only two things that can happen. One, you got unlucky. So you underperformed by a full game. You were either unlucky, but if that keeps happening year after year after year, where you should win 9 games and you win 7 or you win 8, and you consistently underperform that, you can't blame that on chance. Then you have to start looking at what are the other factors that could be getting in the way of you winning. And that's what, in my mind, I would consider kind of a coaching effect. The opposite of that is teams that should win 8 games per year but regularly win 9 or 10. Kansas State is the perfect example of this. Every year, Kansas State seems like it outperforms its expectations. Its expectations based on its scores are like 6.5 games, 7.5 games. It regularly outperforms those. And I really think that speaks to the quality of
Bill Snyder.
Bill Snyder as a coach, that he can regularly squeeze one extra win per season. And sort of the games that come down to chance, the ones that are decided by 3 points or less, that really are just a toss up based on who has the football when last.
Right.
He is able to manipulate that, or he's the master of that. Pelini was never very good at that. And Nebraska tended to underperform. We rarely, under Pelini, got to where we should have. And it seems like he tended to get in the way of winning at least one game per year. So that's at its core, that's the Pythagorean theorem is pretty complicated, and I would almost say that maybe we should do another show based solely on that.
And I agree, but the reason I wanted to bring it up is because there's one point that you made about it that I think matters more now than it will later.
Okay.
And that's the regression idea.
Okay. Let's get back. Let's talk about Central Florida again is a good example. Looking at Central Florida between 2009 and 2015, they won 8, 11, 5, 10, 12, 9, and then 0 games. Each of those years, in when they won 8 and they won 11, and so in 2009 and 2010, they actually were over by about half a game of their expected wins. Now, a half a game isn't that big of a deal, but 2011, when they won 5 games, I think they just really got unlucky because they were 3.5 games under what they should have won based on the number of points. And I think that that just comes down sometimes to the ball bouncing the wrong way. Or was it Dan Alexander dropping the football for no reason on the 1 yard line versus Texas? Completely inexplicable things happening over and over and over again for a season, just getting snake bit by bad luck. They were 3.5 games underperforming. And that showed. Then the very next year, with largely the same team, they bounced back to 10 wins in 2012. And then in 2013, they were at 12 wins. Teams that underperform significantly tend to bounce back the next year, particularly if that underperforming is like a real big valley in the graph. And you're just chugging along, fairly straight line, and then this huge drop off, and then you can expect to bounce back. Now, it works the other way, too, that in 2013, when they won 12 games, I think they got lucky because they were 2.5 games over their expected win total for that year. They won 12. The expected wins would have been 9.5. And what happened in 2014? They dropped to 9 wins, which was almost dead on what they were expected to win. And then the bottom fell out in 2015. And they underperformed in 2015, and they really underperformed in 2016. They were almost 2 games underperforming in 2016 based on the number of points. So you would expect Central Florida to bounce back this year in a pretty, pretty significant way. Now, bouncing back to 12 wins was unexpected.
Right.
But going from 6 wins in 2016 to say 8 or 9 would have been anything less than 9 wins would have been a little bit surprising for UCF this year. Going 12-0 is a pretty big accomplishment.
So then, statistically speaking, purely statistically speaking, if Frost would have stayed at UCF, the expectation then would be that he would snap back to like 9 wins this year, next year.
I think so, because this year I have them at 2.5 wins over where their point total says they should be. So I think that if Frost had stayed, and honestly, I think that we'll see this with Josh Heupel at UCF next year as well, is that there's a drop-off. There almost has to be because there's not much place you can go once you're perfect.
Right.
But I would say that Central Florida, even without looking at their returning players next year, will probably be an 8-win team next year. And we can revisit this in a year, but I would be surprised if Central Florida I would not be surprised if they were an 8 or 9 win team next year.
Did Nebraska meet its expected wins last season, or did they underperform?
You mean in 2017?
Yeah.
We were dead on. The expectation was 3.96 wins. We won 4.
Wow.
We could not have been any closer. In 2016, we were almost 2 wins over where we won 9. I expected us to win 7.1 games.
Can you go ahead.
And in 2015, when it felt like everything went wrong, a Hail Mary, you know, comes to mind.
Right.
We were almost 2 games under. We won 6. I had us winning 7.8. So there's this regression to the mean that if things are kind of unlucky and it's not really a coaching effect, you should expect to bounce back, because that's how math works. Is that over the long term, the law of large numbers says that given sufficient trials, looking in this case number of seasons, the average of this will be pretty close to zero. And that's what we're seeing. If you're over 1 year, you're probably going to get closer to zero the next year. It's just, that's hashtag math, I guess.
Can you semi-confidently give an idea of what we should expect for next season using this, or does it only work in retrospect?
Well, there is some predictive value. But the real predictive value is as a team underperforms or overperforms. This year, we were dead on where we expected to be, which tells me that, I don't know what it tells me. It doesn't tell me a lot, other than we weren't a very good team this year.
Fair.
But I think we probably, looking at the previous years, we probably should, in 15, we should have won 8. Last year, we should have won 7 or 8. I think we probably, with largely the same players, should have won at least 7 this year. But things didn't go that way.
Right.
And that's where you start to blame the coaches. Or maybe not blame, but say, listen, this can only be on you. You know, you let a team that certainly had the potential, given our weak conference, our weak division, and the players that we had, we should have done better than we did. So this is where the guys the Dr. Tom Osborne, Doctorate of Education guys, educational psychology, start digging into what went wrong.
Right.
But to answer your question about predicting next year, I don't know if statistically, because a coaching change can really mess things up.
Numbers wise,
it's kind of a draw a line and start the calculations over, because you have to be careful, because that does change a lot. But fundamentally, however, we're still going to be playing with the same players. Nebraska, for the previous 4 seasons, from 13 to 16, on defense anyway, we were at 25, 26, 27, 24 points per game. And then last year, or in 2007, we bounced up to 36.5 points per game on defense, or scoring defense. That's significant. Our offensive production has been pretty constant for the previous 3 or 4 years, but our defense absolutely tanked this year. And I would say that were I doing an audit, sort of a state of the program report, that would be one of the things that I would focus in on and say, this number seems aberrant to me. What happened? And I think that crazy Bob Diaco is what happened.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Might not need mathematical analysis for that one.
Yeah.
No. Sometimes all this is, sometimes the answer really is that easy, that you hired the wrong guy.
It would be really funny if you off. I was just going to say, it would be really funny if you did the math and somehow you took the number it gave you, turned it upside down, and it spelled Diaco.
No, I'm not going to go there. You mean like, you know, when we did the thing with the calculator? Do you guys
with boobs? Yeah, boobless.
Old enough to remember calculators where you typed in something and you turned it upside down and it said hello?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you did hello? Yeah. I did boobless.
Yeah.
It's 5537-8008, and then you turn it upside down and it says boobless.
I don't even want to know why you remember that.
Because I just did it yesterday. I showed my wife last night.
Okay. To answer your question, I think Nebraska is going to do better next year because, one, I think we've got a really big upgrade in the coaching staff with largely the same players, and it looks like we're going to continue to bring in another pretty good recruiting class. At least I'm not seeing the kind of, a dead year in recruiting that sometimes happens when you have a coaching change. I don't think Frost is letting that happen. The barometer for that will be if we can actually get Bookie onto campus next year. That would be the big fish of the class, of course, especially on defense, where we need the help. And just the fact that we had this real drop-off in performance on the field with pretty much the same players, which tells me that we have athletes that are able to compete at a higher level and are probably ready to compete right away to challenge Wisconsin, certainly to be challenging Iowa and Northwestern for number two. And that would be a step up from this year. Yeah. I encourage Husker fans to, if we do go 6-6 or 7-5 next year, to say, you know what, that's what happens. Now, if we're going 6-6 in 2020, there may be problems.
Right.
But we'll see.
We'll see.
Yeah. I like this.
This is great. And sorry, Pat.
No, that's it. I like it.
Yeah.
That was the gist of it.
I've had so many cups of coffee that my mouth starts running before my brain does.
It happens.
Yeah.
I don't know that it's coffee.
But I just wanted to say thanks again, Paul, for coming on, and we really appreciate it. And we'll definitely have you back on at some point during the off season to do this again.
Okay. All right.
Cool.
Hey guys, thanks for the opportunity.
Oh,
thanks,
Paul.
I had a lot of fun.
Awesome.
We did too.
We did too. Thanks, man.
All right. Big Red.
Go Big Red.
Go Big Red.
This has been a Boardwalk Audio podcast. For more information and shows, visit boardwalkaudio.com. Don't forget to rate and subscribe now.
The Sea of Red, Husker Nation.
See what makes Nebraska fans the greatest fans in college football with a new movie directed by Lincoln native Ryan Tweedy.
Through These Gates.
The perfect gift for Husker fans.
Available on DVD now at huskerfilm.com.